Hi, listeners. You can now listen to this community podcast production ad-free on Apple Podcasts and access the podcast 1 week early and get exclusive bonus content. Just hit the subscribe button now on Apple Podcasts. Or if you want access to all of the above, plus video versions of the podcast, head to patreon.com/stopthekilling.
Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
I'm Sarah Ferris, true crime podcaster.
And I'm Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
And you're listening to Stop the Killing.
Hello, fellow podcast lovers. I wanted to share with you some of the details of the incredibly extensive report, hundreds of pages, that was released in the last few weeks about the Uvalde critical incident, the shooting at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. And the summary of the facts, the Department of Justice put out a larger report that had a lot of details. And instead of going through all of the entire report, which is hundreds of pages, first, I just wanted to tell you in this short fashion, what are the facts that Department of Justice identified and kind of the key facts that were critical to the response and the failure to respond at Robb Elementary School. So I'm going to give you just a, even though we've talked about it on a podcast already, which we'll drop in the show notes, I'm going to just give you a little bit of a recitation of the facts and some of the findings that Department of Justice found as it plowed through all of the official records after the fact. So we're all on the same page about what the facts were with regard to the Robb Elementary shooting in May of 2022, when 19 children and two adults were killed and an uncertain number of people were injured, but upwards of more than a dozen. And I'll explain that. So the shooting occurred, as I mentioned, on the morning of May 24th. It was essentially the last day of school, and the school had given out awards to children, and some of the children had left with their parents after the awards, and other children had stayed behind to stay with the classmates and to watch movies and to kind of have a little fun their last day of school. So the subject came into the building at 11:33, and you may have seen some of the video coverage of this, camera footage that was released by the school district eventually in Texas. The shooter came in a side door. He had with him an AR-15 style weapon. And he came down a hallway, took a turn, and went right towards two classrooms that have an adjoining door between them, classrooms 111 and 112. Behavioral experts at the FBI believe are doing a separate evaluation of the subject himself. And so perhaps we'll get a chance to see that at some point, but I'm not sure when and if that will come out. So I wanted to give you a little bit of the details. And of course, as you know, I'm not going to name a subject, but I will tell you that within 3 minutes of getting into the school, there were 11 law enforcement officers from both the school district and the local police department inside the school. So 3 minutes in, five of those responding first on the scene, they call them FOSs, five of those first on the scene law enforcement officers ran directly to the classroom. They could see where the subject was going and they could hear the rounds being discharged. and they went all the way to the classroom. Five of those went to the classroom. Six of them did not advance down the hallway, and that included the acting chief, who really was in the best position to start talking command and control at that point. And that's important. The command and control is kind of like a who's in charge, and command and control gives us the first opportunity to take a chaotic situation and control it to execute as best we all can. So within those first few minutes, one of the officers is heard saying, you know, line up to make entry. And within seconds, they hear shots being fired from inside one of the classrooms. When those five officers are down the hallway and those shots are fired, two of the officers are hit with shrapnel and they retreat. Everybody retreats from the doorway. In terms of how we train for law enforcement to respond to a shooter, this is the first very visible sign that something is going to go way wrong. We didn't have the visual at the time, but when we saw it afterwards, it was very obvious that the law enforcement officers who were there did not respond. I can tell you that one of my friends from this world who trains in this stuff sent me a message the very next morning and said, if you haven't seen the newly released video of the police inside the school, please do. It's infuriating to watch the clown show of cowardice. So the officers did not go in per protocol, per training, but there's a little bit more to the story when it comes to protocol and training. So we'll move on and give you a little bit more. They did attempt to reapproach the classroom three times. They are seen moving down. Some of them are seen moving down the hallway and they stop. And with the shooting stopped, they try to maybe evacuate some of the classrooms or negotiate with the subject. And they're clearly, there's record that they asked for additional responders, additional equipment, and they make some people, I say they, but there was no they, there was no command and control. Department of Justice is relying on the physical body camera footage that they see, the audio that's coming from that camera footage, video that's coming from the school, interviews that are done of the officers afterwards. And they see that within a quick few minutes after that, the attempt to approach the door and then the shrapnel that hits a couple of officers and they retreat, that very quickly the people involved in this, some over the radio, begin to describe the subject in this, the shooter, as barricaded or contained somehow. That is the second immediate concern that I have as a responder in terms of communications and what could be in this case kind of a fatal error in an understanding of the facts. Because as they report, the subject is barricaded or contained, which you, I don't want to say you never, but an active shooter subject who's shooting is not a barricaded subject. And I'm going to pause here and tell you that last week I was in Texas and I was speaking to a huge room of school officials and teachers who included two school people from Uvalde. And one of them asked me, you know, within minutes, what are police supposed to do when someone's barricaded? And that's because the people in Uvalde have heard that word, barricaded. And I explained to her and to the rest of the people there, barricaded is a word that's used so that police know what kind of protocol to use. In an active shooter situation, the protocol is that someone is shooting. And an active shooter, the police protocols require that they go to the shooter to neutralize the threat. Go, whatever you're doing, continue to try to go to the shooter to neutralize the threat, you or whoever you're with or however you can do that in order to stop the killing. A barricaded subject is an indication to law enforcement that some individual is someplace who might be a danger. However, he is in a contained or barricaded area and therefore no longer a threat to those who are around him and no longer necessarily a threat to those outside unless they step forward. Sometimes you want to wait a barricaded subject out, and meaning that maybe they're holed out in a house and maybe you want to cut the power off or cut the gas off so they can't turn the heat on and eventually they get tired, or you want to hope that they might want to give themselves up and you send in a hostage negotiator to try to get them to appreciate that things could get a lot worse, but they could also get a lot better if they stepped out now or they put their weapons down and they came out now. Those are barricaded subjects, and police protocols are completely different for barricaded subjects than they are for an active shooter. So the second thing that the Department of Justice points out in their 600-page report is that responders are repeatedly describing the subject over the radio as barricaded or contained. That's wrong. And we know it's wrong for a number of reasons, because the fact of the matter is the kids were in school. And so within a handful of minutes of these first officers arriving on the scene, the 911 operators are reporting, the 911 dispatchers are reporting that the class is in session and they are receiving calls from victims. Now, complicating that, as the Department of Justice notes, is that Chief Pete Arredondo, who was the chief of the Uvalde Consolidated Independent School District at the time, Chief Arredondo was directing officers. Well, initially he wasn't directing officers. He couldn't direct them by radio because, in fact, although he had two issued radios that he should have been carrying with him, he didn't have either of those radios with him. So he had a cell phone, but basically he was talking to people in the hallways, and that's how he was communicating. And as more and more law enforcement officers showed up because they knew there was a shooting at the school, that made command and control incredibly difficult and non-existent, in fact. So what happened in reflection is that the Department of Justice said, here's what they saw the chief doing. The chief was directing officers, although he said he was never in charge. He was directing officers at several points to delay making entry into the classroom in favor of searching for keys or clearing other classrooms. He wanted to make sure that the people in the other classrooms were safe. And so they also asked for tactical teams to come, and some of them wanted different equipment, like something you can hold up in front of you that's a shield, you know, to prevent you getting shot. There were also, later we learned, efforts to bring a drone to the area or a sniper who might be able to look for the subject in the building through the classroom windows. So what happened is we heard over and over call outs on the radio for additional resources, and call outs that indicated people were waiting for more equipment or waiting for tactical teams, or they were busy clearing other classrooms. And since he didn't have his radios, he couldn't communicate with anybody. And then immediately afterwards, of course, as we heard, he said, well, I really wasn't in charge. Now, he was the chief of the school district police. So by default, if he was there first, he would be in charge. But even the next in command or whoever was not a team that went down the hallway, there was, it's not about rank and who's in charge. It's about somebody taking charge. And so we definitely know that that didn't happen. And that was a huge problem, huge problem.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Have you ever felt that pang of disappointment when you couldn't add a ticket to your collection because it was digital? Or maybe you just lost it? Well, StubForge.com is here to change that. Imagine this: tickets that not only look but feel like the real deal. Because each ticket from StubForge is printed on the same quality stock that Ticketmaster uses and printed with genuine ticket printers. It's like holding a piece of the concert, the game, or the show right in your hands. But StubForge isn't just about replacing tickets. With the easy-to-use interactive designer, you can create custom tickets for anything, from concerts to sports games, pregnancy announcements, or parties. Why not make your invitations stand out with tickets that are as unique as your event? And if you're trying to complete a back catalogue of missing tickets, StubForge offers bulk discounts to make it both easy and affordable. With StubForge, you can once more give your loved ones physical tickets and see their eyes light up instantly at the best gift you can give. So whether you're looking to reignite your ticket collection, craft the perfect gift, or send the coolest invites, head over to StubForge.com. Start creating today and see how StubForge makes every ticket a story worth saving. Visit StubForge.com and start making tickets today.
So next, let me just give you a few more details because you can hear me flipping papers because I want to make sure that I get to the right details. So many officers arrived at the scene. And when they arrived at the scene, they were hearing a lack of urgency. They were hearing mixed and wrong information. The police officers responding were hearing that possibly the subject had already been killed or that the police chief Arredondo was already in the room with the subject and was negotiating and talking to him. So that was all inaccurate information. And it made it very difficult for anybody arriving to actually know how they could help. And then there was nobody in charge. So that made it for medical officials responding, the ambulances even, they were dealing with blocked streets. They couldn't even get to the schools. Families were coming to the schools. They couldn't get to the schools. They couldn't get any information. Now, I will say that is not uncommon in these kind of chaotic situations. It is important that when you have command and control, someone is charged to make sure that there is a location for family, for survivors, for civilians to respond. Go to some place where they can be safe, but also get accurate information. That never happened. And as we know, if you watch some of this, that there were hundreds of parents and civilians who showed up outside and some who tried to get inside the school building because they didn't see any activity, any movement or any haste in terms of the law enforcement group. And then what that resulted in were actually threats to arrest parents who were trying to go in to save their kids, which is probably the most offensive details that came out. But 48 minutes after the subject entered the school, the subject fired four additional shots inside the classroom. So officers moved forward into formation outside the classroom door, but they never made entry. They presumed the doors were locked, which I think we found out later they were not, right? But they tried to test different keys on some of the other doors, looking for a way to get into the doors. The chief didn't have any keys. He didn't know how to get any keys. And it seemed that neither did other people. And so imagine 48 minutes after the subject enters the school, there are four more additional rounds discharged and still no one goes through the door. Officers who were interviewed said, you know, we knew if we went through the door, we'd be killed, or we were fearful that we'd be killed. After another 15 minutes, officers find a second set of keys, and they use them to open a janitor's closet that's nearby. They open the janitor's closet looking to see if they can find, you know, more keys that will get them into the classroom. This is the same time when they are looking for and waiting and hoping that maybe a sniper from outside the building or a drone can get sight or eliminate the subject through a window, which never happens. And I don't know that it was ever coordinated enough to do that. Another 27 minutes later, after hearing multiple gunshots from inside, 75 minutes after the first responders first enter the elementary school, officers open the door to room 111 and a team of law enforcement enter the room and kill the subject. When he comes out of a closet shooting. So he's killed at 12:50. The initial entry into the building is at 11:33, and he's killed at 12:50. The DRJ calculates, as we've heard before, 77 minutes after the first officers entered the school, 77 minutes after the first officers entered the school. And during that time period, 45 rounds are discharged by the shooter. So that's a big breath of air here for those kinds of details, just to give you the basics about what happened when the shooting occurred. The law enforcement officers who responded, the Department of Justice noted, included both the Uvalde Consolidated Independent School District Police and also Uvalde Police Department officers. In addition to that, the U.S. Border Patrol Tactical Unit, BORTAC, responded. Texas Department of Public Safety responded. and the people who entered the school included members of the, entered the doorway, included members of the U.S. Border Patrol Search, Trauma, and Rescue Team unit is BORSTAR, as well as BORTAC members. I should say BORSTAR, which BORTAC is part of. And deputies from two local sheriff's offices entered the room, and officers killed the subject when he came out of the closet, as I mentioned. So in the school at the time, the hecticness of what was going on in the school at the time, there were 587 children and many other teachers and staff. The people, once accounted for, there were 19 children and two staff members killed, and at least 17 survivors who were physically injured. But many of the individuals there who sought medical assistance or maybe didn't, they did it on their own. And so it's really unknown, even at this time, how many people were injured, but at least 17 were injured. And I'll say that does happen a lot. We saw that at the Boston bombing. We saw that at the shooting in Las Vegas. Anytime there's a tragedy, many people, even Pulse Nightclub, people self-report to the hospital or they go home and tend to their wounds themselves if it's not too bad. So a lot of the wounded and deceased were transported to Uvalde Memorial Hospital and some to the Uvalde Civic Center where the victims were transported. There was a reunification center eventually set up where the families could be reunited with their families. The children could be reunited with families or adults. But there was a lot of incorrect information some of the most chilling information that came out is that there were family members who were told that their family member survived, but then later they found out they hadn't. And the opposite, there were some who were notified that their family member had died and that they found out they hadn't. But either way, one of the other things that Department of Justice noted, because they have a whole component that just handles victims and survivors and support for victims of crimes, they recognized in this report by the Department of Justice that there were people notified of the deaths of their family member by personnel who were not trained to deliver that kind of news. So in the days and weeks that followed, it was just one kind of tragedy after another as people couldn't get information on what happened, didn't get information on what happened, and everybody was very busy pointing left and then pointing right and then pointing left and then pointing right about who was responsible or who was accountable. We saw that play out in the news. The chief did an interview with the, I believe it was a Texas Star Tribune right away saying, you know, I wasn't in charge and I didn't do it. And he was very quick to say that. And the DPS people were there saying, here's what we think and what we were responsible for. That's why the value of this Department of Justice report is just, it's very long, but it's a very long recitation of all the facts of the case. The district attorney in that area is debating whether or not anyone, law enforcement or otherwise, should be charged in any way. And I think that it was logical that she would wait for this Department of Justice report that's so detailed so that she has an accurate set of all the known facts all at once. So based on all these facts, the team that the Department of Justice puts together to do this, very rarely does the Department of Justice do this type of review. They did it on the request of the mayor's office to do a critical, what we call a critical incident review. So in this critical incident review, they do an analysis of the people and the activities and say, match the facts that we know with the outcome, what was good, what was bad, what you can do better next time. That's what a critical incident review does. You try to stay pretty factual. I'm going to tell you, the opening paragraph of their analysis says, based on these facts, the CIR team, the critical incident review, based on these facts, the CIR team identified several critical failures and other breakdowns prior to, during, and after the Robb Elementary School response and analyzed the cascading failures of leadership, decision-making, tactics, policies, and training that contributed to those failures and breakdowns. From the facts and analysis, the CIR team has been able to identify generally accepted practices for an effective law enforcement response to similar mass shootings and offer recommendations in hopes that in the future, law enforcement would be able to act quickly, save lives, and prevent injuries to the greatest extent possible. And even the executive summary for this is, I think, 40-some pages long. I'm just going to point out, because I know I've been talking for a long time, a handful of their major conclusions at this point. First of all, the CIR team points out that everyone on the scene should have immediately understood that this was an active shooter situation. active shooter situation, meaning how police are supposed to respond. The school district had hosted a active shooter training, so they said, 2 months earlier. And everybody involved should have understood this was an active shooter situation and that barricaded is not an opportunity that you turn to when you have a subject who's still shooting people inside a classroom. That's not a barricaded subject. The active shooter situation that we recognized right away, and we've recognized since the Columbine High School tragedy in 1999, requires this fast response to immediately neutralize the subject, and everything else, including officer safety, is subordinate to that objective because the officers are better prepared and equipped to go through that door than the children and the teachers lying on the floor inside bleeding out. You know, we had terrible facts that came out during the pendency of this, as this report was being put together. We knew and learned early on that one of the two teachers who was killed is married to a law enforcement officer who arrived on the scene and came inside the school and took his gun out because he wanted to go through the door. And the other police officer stopped him and he said, "My wife is inside. She called me. She's been shot." And so they knew there were people inside bleeding. We also know there was a little girl in the classroom who had talked about this with her family, and she knew what to do. And so she called 911. She was very articulate. She explained that there were people all around her who had been shot, and could the police please get there as soon as they could? And that did not happen for quite a long time. So the law enforcement officers who responded should have known this was an active shooter situation and should have known how to respond. In interviews that were done afterwards, some of the officers said, "Well, I didn't hear any noise, so I didn't really know if there was anybody in there." That's, again, lack of leadership. That's maybe a justification because you got to live with yourself and what you did or didn't do. You know, I feel sorry for that officer who left his wife. You know, I worry that he's on a suicide watch now because, you know, he's going to always say, "I should have done this or I should have done that," when in fact he did as much as he could have done at the time. But the idea that people inside the school weren't noisy enough for the law enforcement officers. Well, first of all, we know now from the Department of Justice report that within a handful of minutes of them entering the school, dispatchers were reporting to them that school was still in session. And what do we train our children in these schools to do? If I would train them, I would train them to run, hide, or fight. But a lot of schools don't train to all three of those, run, hide, fight. A lot of schools train to the hide part, which is lockdown. And there's other versions of that language you may use in your school district or in your community. On whatever that middle ground is, you either move away from the threat, you bunker down to protect yourself from the threat, or you attack the threat because you're in risk of imminent death yourself. So run, hide, or fight. When we teach children to hide or to lock down or to, you know, turn the lights out, we teach them and all adults to be quiet. There's no reason anyone who's trained an active shooter would have to listen for somebody to talk in order to know if they're there. It doesn't make any sense at all when it comes to training. So it tells me that many of these officers, as Department of Justice report indicated, maybe weren't trained. The second thing that they found is this astonishing 77-minute gap and said, that is not just that you didn't understand it was an active shooter situation, several of you, but then you didn't engage for 77 minutes, including a huge amount of time where you had already heard shots inside. You're standing in the building hearing shots, but then they retreated. Then they looked for, particularly directed by Chief Arredondo, to look for any other reason to do anything else. And he actually directed officers who were seeking to gain entry into the classroom to stop because he wanted other classrooms to be emptied out. He wanted the building to be emptied of the children who were there already, which is the run part of run, hide, fight. And so he was telling officers to break windows and take kids out of classrooms to get the building cleared before anybody went in. So first thing, it's an active shooter situation. How come you didn't recognize that? The second part, 77 minutes before you engage, the Department of Justice said, no. As more law enforcement officers and resources arrived, first responders on the scene, including those with specific leadership responsibilities, did not coordinate any immediate entry into the classrooms. And that absolutely runs counter to the generally accepted practices for active shooter response, to immediately engage the subject. Instead, they focused on looking for equipment and getting other people out of the classrooms and looking for keys for a door they thought was locked and things like that. So then the next thing that they identified specifically was an overall failure to act properly, even when they heard the gunshots at 12:21. Remember, they first responded inside the school at 11:33. At 12:21, which was 50 minutes later, they heard more gunshots, and yet they still did not add any urgency to their response. That's astonishing. I mean, disappointing, yet not surprising. Part of the challenge to this is the third thing that the critical incident review pointed out is that there was just no incident command structure at all. There was no one who was in charge enough to make decisions and turn to things. And a lot of people outside said they thought the chief was inside. Chief had no radios, and the chief was saying, I'm not in charge. But he was, in fact, directing some people to do things like gaining and not stopping people from gaining entry into the classroom. So all of these officers, any law enforcement officer, just like any first responders, should have, and honestly, you do have through training and training academies, incident command training. So why all of the vast majority of the officers from all these different law enforcement agencies weren't thinking about incident command? I'm sure many of them were, but they clearly were functioning on that information. And the people who were closest to the scene who could have created the incident command structure in that hour that they were standing in the hallways, they chose not to. And everybody else involved, it cost them, right? It cost everybody else involved. The other thing that Department of Justice pointed out is that it was clear that with all these different law enforcement agencies, this is very critical when you think about when you run some exercises at your school. It was very obvious that the law enforcement agencies had never trained together. I live in the National Capital Region, Washington, D.C. area, and when I was in the FBI Washington field office, I think we had 20-some law enforcement agencies and first responder agencies that always were trained together. And it's essential to do that so that if something happens, you know, at the Holocaust Memorial Museum, as we saw, you know, when I was there, or at the Navy Yard, that everybody who responds understands what everybody else is trained in doing. The Department of Justice said it was clear that the officers from these different law enforcement agencies had never trained together. And that is an important lesson learned about something that you need to do. So there are many other things that the report goes through in detail. I think that the biggest things for me, and the thing that hurts my head the most, is that, you know, for instance, when the chief said, hey, we want to protect the other children and teachers, so we're going to just clear out every other classroom first. When I say that, and I say it took a little time, it took 43 minutes to clear out the other classrooms. And so they were, like I said, finally evacuating people through windows. There were many opportunities to go in through that door. And my last thought about the lack of urgency, and we all know what the result was, 19 children and 2 adults who died, and how we all try to come up with one thing or another, I should have, I could have. And I recognize that here I am, second guessing law enforcement officers who may or may not have chosen to go through the door. I think that's the hard part for law enforcement. I certainly have spent 20 years as an FBI agent, and I had my gun out more than I wanted to, but not nearly probably as much as a street officer has their gun out. It's a high-risk job, and you shouldn't take the job if you can't focus on the training and take the seriousness of the training and understand that you're saving lives. Because when a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old or an 8-year-old, you know, is laying on the floor on the other side of the wall from you, and is watching her teacher bleed out and watching her classmates bleed out, and some of them blown apart because this was a AR-15 style rifle, and she has the wherewithal to call the 911 dispatcher and provide extensive details about classroom numbers and what she sees and what she hopes. And the dispatcher is in a position where she had to then keep this young lady on the line and listen to what was going on through this young lady's head and what was going on. When law enforcement did finally go through that door with all of the equipment that it had for a very long time, they went through that door. They confronted the subject. The subject came out of a closet that he was hiding in. He came out of a closet and shot at them, and they took the subject down. No law enforcement officer was killed. We had 11 law enforcement officers in the building 3 minutes into the shooting. And a lot of them had a lot of equipment with them, and there was more equipment that arrived within minutes. And yet no law enforcement officer in this environment, maybe a little bit of groupthink, right? Where together, no one was in charge. And because no one was in charge, no one was in charge. And yet when they did go through the doors, the subject was killed, and the law enforcement officers who had all the equipment they had practically an hour prior, all that equipment, none of the law enforcement officers were wounded. There's so much more in this report, but I just wanted to give you some of the details of it so you could kind of begin to plow through it. Because I think that when people saw the report, saw the size of it, and they were like, holy cow, hundreds of pages, how am I going to get through that? One of the Uvalde teachers who I spoke to last week when I was in Austin said, I didn't want to read the report, but I felt that I had to read it. And so it took me 2 days, but I just sat down and read it. And all I could think of was, I hope that never, ever happens to any teacher again, that they have to read this kind of report and a failure of this kind of action.
Thanks for listening. And if you want to know more, Catherine's book, Stop the Killing, is out now. For more details, go to CatherineSchweit.com. Please consider also supporting our independently made podcast. It's simple to do. Go to patreon.com/stopthekilling. And for as little as the price of a latte a month, you can be part of the solution to stop the killing. Patreon rewards range from official do-gooder status to ad-free episodes, autographed books, and opportunities to connect with us directly for your business, school, church, or even just a book club chat. But just knowing that you are part of a movement that has the power to make your community safer, well, that's got to taste better than a skinny cappuccino any day. So please head to patreon.com/stopthekilling now and polish off your do-gooder halo, and make sure to include your name so we can give you a shout out. This podcast is a Community podcast production. That's Con with an N. If you want more content, then head over to Community Podcast at Instagram, where you'll find trailers on more binge-worthy true crime, like the award-winning podcast Conning the Con. And check out our show notes for all the links mentioned. Finally, if you want one takeaway action that you can do right now that can help make our community safer, please share, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen. Everybody needs to know that they hold the keys to see something and say something. Together, we can stop the killing.
It's one of those things you hope never happens, but you better train for it, because it will happen, and it will happen in places you wouldn't expect. Be ready for it.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, I'm Matt Harris. Seton Tucker and I host the podcast Impact of Influence, which for 2 years covered in depth Alec Murdoch, who was eventually convicted in 2023 of murdering his wife Maggie and son Paul. That story continues to evolve, and we will cover that, plus we will tell you stories of other true crime events that have happened in the South. Please join us on Impact of Influence and give us a follow on the Impact of Influence Facebook page.